Just a reminder, today's conference is being recorded.
All right, Teresa, take it away.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Welcome to our first conference call of 2010 for the National Technical Assistance Center in Voting and Cognitive Access. My name is Teresa Moore, and I'm going to be your facilitator today. Our topic today is supporting voters in congregate care, outreach and training in institutions and group homes. This call will last about an hour and a half. And just that reminder that you will be recorded today so that we can use this in the future. It was one of our most popular topics, so we wanted to make sure that if there's information that you'd like to have later that you have access to it. We will be joined by four speakers today from four different states who will share their experience about this topic. Our guest speaker today is Paul O'Hanlon, an attorney from the Disability Rights Network in Pennsylvania, Kate Bowden, an attorney from Rhode Island Disability Law Center, Mary Pofstimski, an advocate for the Disability Rights in Vermont, and Mickey Kawai, an elections manager in the Washington County in Oregon. After I introduce the call, each of our speakers will answer questions for me, and it'll take about 15 to 20 minutes. There will be time for questions after each speaker, so please keep that in mind and jot down any questions that you have as we go along. We do have listeners from 19 states. We have Alaska, California, Colorado, Delaware, Georgia, Louisiana, Maine, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Mississippi, New Jersey, Ohio, Oregon, Rhode Island, South Carolina, Texas, Vermont, Washington, West Virginia, and Washington, D.C. represented. I want to give you some information to get you prepared for the call. There's some statistics I'd like to share. We would like to support and assist voters who are living in care facilities. Currently, 3.2 million Americans are living in nursing homes alone. Many are the people who have some form of disability. According to the U.S. Census, the number of Americans who are 55 and older will increase between 2007 to 2030 from 20% to 31%. That is more than a million people total who may need some type of assistance to live. It is estimated that 7 to 8 million Americans nationwide experience an intellectual disability. According to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, almost 2.2 million Americans are in nursing homes or in some and have some level of cognitive disability. Not all live in the traditional institutions that we know and think about, but while in large institutions for people with cognitive disabilities in the 20th century are slowly being replaced by living with their family and or have some support in their communities in group homes. The U.S. Department of Health claims that 129,000 people continue to live in large institutions. This call will discuss the different ways that groups and states have found to support voters living in different kinds of congregate care facilities. To register to vote and successfully carry out their ballot, we will hear about the different methods, experiences, all in the same important goal, to allow all citizens to exercise their right to vote. Regardless of the structure of your home, whether it is segregated setting or not, people with disabilities should have the appropriate access to cast their ballot and freely vote and privately vote. The speakers on our panel today will share their experiences and ideas that made this possible.
Teresa, this is Ersa. Can I remind everyone listening, the mute button for your phone is *6. When it's time for questions to unmute, it's also *6. Thanks, Teresa.
Thank you, Ersa. I'd like to introduce Paul O'Hanlon from the Disability Rights Law Network in Pennsylvania. Paul O'Hanlon is a 1979 graduate from the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Before working at DRN, Mr. O'Hanlon was the senior housing attorney with the Neighborhood Legal Services Association in Pittsburgh. Mr. O'Hanlon has been a member of the Pennsylvania Developmental Disabilities Council since 1992 and is currently the chairperson of the Allegheny County City of Pittsburgh Task Force on Disabilities. Now I have a few questions for Mr. O'Hanlon. Are you ready, Paul?
I am. Hi, Teresa.
All right. Can you tell us about the basic information about Pennsylvania and how voting works there? Is there an absentee voting common? Is there a difference between the urban and rural voting in Pennsylvania?
Well, in Pennsylvania, the basic way to vote is that people go to their...
Excuse me, I can hear you who's trying to call someone back. Could you please do the star 6, please? Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry,
but most the expectation, I think, in Pennsylvania is that most voters would vote in their neighborhood precinct. And there is the right to vote by absentee ballot. But in order to be eligible to vote by absentee ballot, you have to fit into one of approximately 13 exceptions. And among the accepted exceptions, meaning within – you're eligible to vote by absentee ballot, for example, if you're elderly or a person with a disability. But the majority of people in Pennsylvania vote in their neighborhood precinct, and absentee balloting, voting by absentee ballot is a far less common way for people to vote. Pennsylvania has a very large rural population. And so within the rural counties in Pennsylvania, transportation can be hard to get, can be sometimes non-existent or kind of difficult. So I think that in rural counties, there probably is a slightly higher percentage of people who vote by absentee ballot. The other thing that I discovered is within the disability community, I think that voting by absentee ballot within the physical disability community is sort of frowned upon because, you know, we've been given the the excuse of, well, you know, the polling place is inaccessible, so you can vote by absentee ballot. But within the mental health community, for example, it's much more accepted, and so there's a difference within different disability communities about the kind of acceptance of absentee voting.
Okay. That's good to know that information. Tell us a little bit about the personal care home system that you have in Pennsylvania.
Okay. Pennsylvania has this kind of thing that they call personal care homes, and it's different. It's distinct from a nursing home. To be nursing home eligible, a person needs to demonstrate a need for skilled nursing services, but a personal care home is different. There are lots and lots of people in Pennsylvania that live in personal care homes. Approximately 50,000 Pennsylvanians live in personal care homes. I think the largest percentage of people living in personal care homes are people who are described as being frail elderly, but there's a very sizable portion of people in personal care homes who have disabilities, and of the people with disabilities, probably the largest group are people with mental health disabilities. And unlike the name, which, you know, personal care home sounds like it's personal caring and home, like the average personal care home in Pennsylvania has between 25 and 50 beds. So they're definitely kind of institutional in nature.
Okay. That's a complex system, it sounds like. Tell us about why you started the voter outreach in the personal care homes, and how did you develop that program?
Well, it started when I started working with a grassroots advocacy group called Let Our Voices Be Heard. And Let Our Voices Be Heard is a kind of cross-disability advocacy group, but the largest number of folks in the group have mental health disabilities. And so we started working in personal care homes because a lot of people in the group either lived in personal care homes or, you know, used to live in a personal care home or had friends or, you know, associates who lived in personal care homes. And what we kind of discovered was within the mental health community, there were a lot of concerns about living in a personal care home. So we started organizing people around personal care home issues, at first mostly around issues of conditions and quality of life. But then at the same time, we as a group, the Let Our Voices Be Heard group, we were starting to get mobilized around voting and voter registration. And as we started doing more and more of that, people within the group sort of said, well, what about our friends in personal care homes? Who's doing outreach to them? And, you know, we quickly found out that, well, nobody was, and nobody was really going to personal care homes to help register people. And so we started training our advocates to go into personal care homes and do voter registration. So it really developed from the relationship that we had with advocates, grassroots advocates, and their concern about kind of their brothers and sisters that were living in personal care homes. So what we started to do was we started to train people in our group to be what we called voter educators, because what we discovered was that there was a big need for information and just education about voting. There are a lot of myths out there about who was and wasn't eligible to vote, you know, and what people, you know, whether you needed to be able to read and write to, you know, to be eligible to vote. You know, we heard all kinds of things. And so we started to train grassroots advocates to go into places like personal care homes to offer voter registration opportunities and to kind of educate their peers about the importance of voting, you know, how you vote, how you register, and all those kinds of things.
Okay. So when you're starting this work at the personal care homes, how did the staff react? Was there resistance or disagreement that you work with the folks?
Well, one of the things we discovered early on was that the people in our grassroots advocacy group were already going into personal care homes kind of on a regular basis to visit with friends or, you know, if they had lived there before, to go back and, you know, just keep up relationships. And so what we discovered was that they could go into personal care homes and nobody even really noticed. You know, when we were organizing around conditions issues and you know, we sometimes people would go in with kind of like a checklist of like, you know, does this place have a fire alarm? Does it have this and that? What we discovered is that the staff never really questioned their being there because they, you know, kind of were there pretty often anyway. And so when we started to do voter registration, it was just very easy to get into these places because people had sort of credibility to be there in the first place. And so the staff never really resisted it at all. In fact, what we usually found was that, you know, the staff kind of appreciated that, number one, that somebody was coming in and interacting with the residents. Number two, that somebody was offering them voter registration opportunities, because a lot of times the staff didn't even kind of, they weren't sure. You know, they didn't know how it all worked themselves, and they didn't know what was, you know, how you did it. So they were kind of appreciative that people were coming in and offering voter registration kind of opportunities. So we literally never had any problem at all for people in our group getting into personal care homes. Now, the truth is that personal care homes are licensed facilities. People do have a right to go in. We could have forced the issue as a PNA to get into a personal care home, but what we found was that it really never came up on voter registration issues. We never got any resistance. So, my sense is that it really is one of those things that people kind of generally think, well, yeah, it's a good thing to do.
Okay. And just to follow up with the voters there, how did you make sure they got to cast their ballots? What kind of follow-up did you do after you registered them?
Yeah, I think that, we sort of learned as we did it. One of the things that we learned, I think, after the first cycle, because, elections come in cycles, and, we kind of got used to each cycle kind of looking back at what we did and did it work? Was it, could we do a better job? One of the things we discovered after our first cycle was that a lot of people in personal care homes weren't getting out to vote on election day, either because it was just really physically too hard for them to do it, or they didn't have any transportation, or they just didn't have any money because, most of their money goes to pay for them to be in the personal care home. And so we started to look at the fact that, we couldn't really stop with just registering people to vote, that we needed to, kind of find out, what kind of support would a person who registers need to vote on election day? And so we discovered that a pretty large proportion of people, given the choice, preferred to vote by absentee ballot. So what we discovered was that, before every election, we would go in probably about 2 months before election day to offer a voter registration opportunity. And then we would go back about a month before the election and find out who wanted to vote by absentee ballot, because you have to apply for and send in an absentee ballot. So we would help people fill out an absentee ballot request. And then we would come back again about a week and a half before election, because by that point the absentee ballots should have been mailed to them, and then we would, assist them in filling out the ballot, see if they needed any help in terms of, anything from reading the ballot to marking the ballot, and then we would help them deposit in the mail, provide, postage and get it in the mail. So we discovered that to really do an effective job, it required 3 visits to a personal care home. And it was good, because the other thing is it really just kept reinforcing both the relationship between the voter educator and the people in the personal care home, and that, that voting is a process. It's, we're trying to get people to understand that, advocacy is not just a, once a year thing where you go on election day, but it's a whole process, and there are a number of things that you need to do to both get ready for election day, to vote on election day, and then to kind of as we did more and more voting work, then what we discovered was that people in personal care homes had different kind of issues that we would then set up meetings with their state legislator and try to get legislators interested in personal care home issues. Lots of people, 50,000 people, that's a lot of people, a lot of votes, and try to kind of reinforce that relationship of kind of voting. Voting can give results.
Great. It sounds like a lot of activity. And I noticed that you sent in a PowerPoint that said we count. Is that some of the training tools you used for your voter education team?
We have a statewide disability voting coalition, the Disability Voting Coalition of Pennsylvania, and One of the campaigns of the Disability Voting Coalition is what we call the We Count campaign. And it's really to try to highlight the whole issue of how bad as a state we're doing to register people with disabilities. The federal law, the National Voter Registration Act, requires all state-funded disability service agencies to offer voter registration to all the consumers that they serve, you know, at intake, change of address, and recertification. But, you know, but what we found, for example, was that in the whole state of Pennsylvania, we have 67 counties and we have 53 counties that for the last 3 years in a row have had no registrations at all by any agencies that serve people with mental health or cognitive disabilities. And we were just shocked to discover that, and we've been trying to highlight the fact that, you know, why are the numbers so bad when people with disabilities in Pennsylvania, we are 20% of the voting age population. Why is it that we're 20% and we account for such a tiny, tiny percentage of registration? So the We Count campaign is kind of designed around to draw attention to, you know, the duty that these agencies have to register to vote, and the potential political power that people with disabilities could have if they register to vote and vote on Election Day. I mean, seniors, for example, are perceived as having enormous political power, and it's not because they all vote for the same candidate, but because they vote. And so people with disabilities, I think, need to learn the lessons that seniors learn, that voting brings political power.
That's true. You've given us a lot of really great information. Is there any last words of advice that you could give to groups that are considering starting this kind of congregate care outreach?
Well, I can't emphasize enough, I think, at least for me, what a difference it made to work with a grassroots advocacy group, because it just gave so much more kind of meaning to the whole reason to vote. And because, you know, not only do we emphasize the importance of voting, but what we do in the process is we discover kind of what people's issues are, you know. And so when we went into personal care homes, we didn't really expect that the issue that we would hear everybody talking to us about was the fact that they hadn't had an increase in their personal spending allowance for over 15 years. And, you know, and dollar doesn't go as far as it used to go 15 years ago. And so when we discovered that that was really the issue that was important to them, then we started to talk about that issue when we met with kind of our elected representatives, and then it became an issue that they cared about. And when we were able to get an increase from the state in the personal needs allowance, which then really helped us when we went back to the personal care home to register people to vote, to kind of show them, you know, this works, this makes a difference. You know, registering to vote and voting can you know, help you in your life, you know. And so I think that for me, the really big thing is to work, find grassroots advocacy groups and to work with them. It got us in the door. It got us credibility. It just has been a great, great experience for me.
Thank you so much. At this time, if there is any immediate questions, we'll take those, just a couple of those, and then we'll have some more time at the end, we hope to. Does anyone have a question?
This is the Mental Health Advisory Council Disability Rights Network. Suzanne Erb speaking.
Yes, I would like to address the whole concept of people with visual impairments and casting the ballot. And I know that Paul is familiar with it. But I would just like to say, as a person with a visual disability, the reason for us why voting at the booth is really important to us is that for those of us who can't see the ballot at all, if someone marks the ballot for us, we have no way to verify that the vote that we cast or how the that the vote that we wanted is the vote that was actually cast. And so that's why for a lot of us, voting at the poll is so important.
Yeah, that's a great point, Susanna, and I totally understand that. The only thing I think that we all need to understand is that within all the various disability communities, there's a very different level of importance given on kind of voting in the precinct versus voting by absentee ballot. And, you know, but I think that be honest with you, my attitude is what's important is to vote, and that each group really should have the right to vote in a way that supports them best. But I think you're right that right now in Pennsylvania, there's really no accessible form of absentee voting.
Something for
you know, the ballots are printed, and if you can't read print, it's not a very effective way.
Excuse me, Paul.
Yes.
My this is Mike Matthews from Triple. My question is, how did you guys inform the people in the personal care homes what candidates were running? And a second part of that question would be, did you inform them where the candidates stood on issues that affected people with disabilities?
The first question in terms of how we inform people of kind of who's running, one of the things that we've tried to do is work closely with our local League of Women Voters, and they've been a really wonderful partner. And the League puts out information before elections as far as, you know, like who's running. And so what we usually would do is we would go when we're, I sort of describe this three-step process. When we go to register people to vote, it's the next point when we go to find out who needs to do an absentee ballot. At that point, generally speaking, we have sample ballots already from the League, and so we hand that out so that people can see kind of what races are up and who's running. But we haven't, the last question you asked in terms of how we communicate to people kind of like who's good and who's bad or who has a good voting record on disability issues and who doesn't. We haven't tried to do that yet. I think that that's something that maybe in the future we'll get to, but at the moment what really our emphasis has been is to kind of really emphasize the importance of voting rather than trying to suggest to people who to vote for. Suggesting to people who to vote for is a real hard issue, particularly for agencies that are required to be nonpartisan. And so we haven't really gotten into or try to do that part of it yet. Mostly right up till this point, we've been kind of emphasizing the fact that, well, you know, you could vote for all kinds of candidates, but if you don't vote at all, then the message that you're giving your elected leaders is people with disabilities don't really vote, and we don't really, you know, if you're an elected politician, you care about votes, and if our community doesn't vote, why should they care about what we feel like or, you know, what our issues are?
That's very true. I'm going to have to move on to our next presenter. If you have further questions for Paul, we'll try to get back to those at the end. I would like to introduce Kate Bowden from Rhode Island. And Kate has been an attorney since 1996 and a staff attorney with the Rhode Island Disability Law Center for 5 years. She is committed to the practice of law in the state and federal courts in Rhode Island and Massachusetts. At the Rhode Island Disability Law Center, she has represented clients in a variety of disability-related legal issues, including eligibility and discharge assessments before the Department of Mental Health and Retardation and hospitals. contest civil right commitment, housing discrimination, guardianship proceedings, and administrative actions before the State Board of Elections regarding accessible voting equipment and voting rights. Since 2004, Ms. Bowden, has served as a coordinator for the Rhode Island Disability Law Center Protection and Advocacy for Voting Access Grant, for which she spearheads systemic advocacy, outreach, and training activities to ensure full participation in the electoral process. Ms. Bowden has been interested in the constitutional rights since her college days, and she has fulfilled it by working on issues concerning preservation and the fundamental right to vote. Ms. Bowden represented two patients in the state psychiatric facility regarding their right to vote. Each of the patients were acquitted of criminal charges upon finding the not guilty by reason of insanity, and their right to vote was challenged based on that ruling. The hearing before the Rhode Island Board of Elections, Ms. Bowden secured a favorable ruling for her clients, and the voting rights were restored. Kate, we'd like to ask you some similar questions that we asked Paul. Tell us about your basic information about your Rhode Island and how they vote works there, and how it is to be the smallest state in the country. So that, and how does that play a part?
Well, yes, Rhode Island is the smallest state, and as an example of that, in the entire state, we have 541 precincts for voting, and some of the locations have more than one precinct. In Rhode Island, you can get from one end of the state in any direction in 1 hour. In Rhode Island, we see that most people vote in, like in Pennsylvania, in the traditional polling places. There is a neighborhood polling place reasonably close to most voters, and within the polling places, we have the Automark voting system for accessible voting. And in addition to that, we also have a mail ballot system for limited circumstances. There's currently legislation pending that might expand that, but currently for a person to be eligible for a mail ballot, you have to fall into certain categories. And one of those categories is if the person is incapacitated to the extent that it would be an undue hardship to vote at the polls because of illness or mental or physical disability, blindness, or serious impairment of mobility. And another way to be eligible for a mail ballot is if the person is confined in any hospital, convalescent home, nursing home, rest home, or similar institution.
Okay. There's already a system to support voters in congregate care. Could you explain the system to us?
Yes. In Rhode Island, our system for congregate care voting is really tied in with our mail ballot system, the one that where I just described the eligibility. So people in hospitals and nursing homes and personal care facilities are eligible for a mail ballot. And if they choose to go that route, once they apply for a mail ballot, state law requires that our Board of Elections send a bipartisan pair of election officials to the facility to ensure privacy of voting for the person who applied for the mail ballot and to provide assistance where needed. So in practice, what happens is, for example, if there's a patient in a state hospital, they're not able to leave the hospital, they apply for a mail ballot, and then before election day, the Board of Elections will send out a bipartisan pair of election officials who will bring the ballot to the facility, provide assistance if needed, and then bring the ballot back to the Board of Elections. And that is by state statute.
Okay. And how did you work to expand that system and maintain the relationships?
Well, one of the things that we do in that regard is to work on educating clients on the existence, clients and people with disabilities on the existence of the system, and also to educate staff in facilities like a state hospital on how to support people with disabilities to take advantage of the system. Because Rhode Island is so small, there were many relationships in place which helped with this process. We as the PNA had relationships with the hospital, which were bolstered by working together on projects when we had a shared agenda. Relationships with the Board of Elections also grew out of some collaborative efforts. For example, in my role here at the Law Center, I'm part of a committee called the Election Access Committee. The Board of Elections is also on that committee, and through doing joint work, I think some strong relationships have grown. We also worked on a video about best practices in working with people who have disabilities, and that was a video for poll workers. So just working on that project helped to strengthen existing relationships between us and the Board of Elections. And also I would say the way that we've handled our advocacy efforts around the voter challenge cases that I handled and some advocacy around complaints regarding the AutoMark voting machine has given us a lot of opportunity to interact with the Board of Elections. And we've taken even situations that were somewhat adversarial, we've used them as ways to build relationships that will lead to other opportunities for collaboration.
Great. And do you do any follow-up before elections occur to make sure that things are going the way they're supposed to?
Well, what we did was we got involved with a program with the Board of Elections at the State Psychiatric Hospital, and we did a joint training there with the Board of Elections regarding voting rights for patients and the process for supporting patients around voting. And because we had relationships in place with the hospital and the Board of Elections, we were really welcomed when we approached the hospital about the idea of doing a training there. So yes, way before elections, we went in and we trained the social workers, and the hospital was very, the Board of Elections was open to this process because it fit into their requirements under the National Voter Registration Act, and once we offered to train the social workers, it led nicely to offering to work with the patients themselves.
Any other areas of trust that you had to build to accommodate any resistance or disagreement with you being there to do the education? Was there any other barriers that you came across?
Well, I have to say that because we had relationships in place and we're offering to do, I mean, similar to what Paul had described, even though this was an institution, they understood that they had responsibilities to facilitate this process. The Board of Elections understood that they had responsibilities as well. And so we were really welcomed into this process. So I can't say that in my experience, there was really a lot of resistance we had to work with.
That's really good that those relationships were strong and ready to work. That made it possible for people to participate. So thinking back about what you've told us, is there any advice that you could give people that are thinking about starting outreach in this type of facility? Is there any advice you have for us that you'd like to share?
Absolutely. I think that it really helps to work hard on collaboration when there is common ground. If, for example, the state hospital reached out to the PNA when they saw that they had psychiatric patients whose right to vote was being challenged. And when my agency offered to represent those folks, the hospital then provided us with some expert testimony so that on that case, that was a time when we could work together. And through working together, the relationship grew. And was that a good place for them to be open to us doing this kind of work within the hospital? So I would say, you know, work on collaboration when there's an opportunity, because that really does give rise to stronger relationships. And if relationships don't exist, as they did in my case, I would consider looking for opportunities to come together in some way so that relationships can be born and lead to those sorts of opportunities.
That's great. I'd like to open up the audience to see if there's any questions for Kate at this time. Anybody have any questions?
This is Ursa at the Vote TA Center. Kate, when you and I had spoken a week or two ago, you'd mentioned that you actually do some work with the patients at the state psychiatric hospital.
Yes, we do. We after training with the social workers, what we did is we focused on making sure that they understood the system and how they could support the patients in utilizing the system. And we also spoke to them about the rights of the patients to pursue this. And once the social workers were trained on the logistics of the mail balloting system, we then did some trainings with the patients in the hospital and really gave them similar information so that they would know how to work with their social worker to apply for the mail ballot and to get that in place, and also so that they would understand, you know, where to go if there was an issue. For example, we had one there was one patient in the hospital who called me the day before election day and said, "Everybody else in the hospital has voted, but they didn't come to me," and I was able to resolve that by making one phone call to the Board of Elections, and you know, they sent somebody out right away. So with the patients, we focused on teaching them the process as well so that they would be able to take advantage of it. And also, because we're the PNA, we focused on talking to them about their rights and the idea that just because they're confined to the hospital doesn't mean that they've lost the right to vote, and issues around the presumption of competence as well.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions for Kate?
Yeah, yes, Kate, this is Mike Matthews. Did you say that on election day that in Rhode Island that two bipartisan election officers will take about to someone in a personal care home?
The system is set up so that in practice what happens is people apply for the mail ballot, I think it's about 20 days before election day, or it's around that time or before that. And then the Board of Elections sends people out to various facilities before election day. So it's not just the day before. It's within the period leading up to the election that they go out to the various places. But I did describe a situation where the day before election day, this patient in the state psychiatric hospital had not yet seen anybody come to see him. So they did send someone out the day before election day in that case.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much, Kate.
My pleasure.
We are now going to meet Mary Postimsky, Disability Rights Vermont. Mary Postimsky has been an advocate with Disability Rights Vermont. Formerly, you might have known it as Vermont Protection and Advocacy. With a background of counseling and psychology and previous employment as a mental health treatment provider in corrections, she began her role at the Vermont Disability Rights Advocacy and primarily worked with PAMI as an advocate. When the PAVA grant came along, she and her coworkers will tell you that she was not the most enthusiastic about shifting focus from investigating abuse and neglect to ensuring that equal rights to voting. However, her experience providing PAVA outreach and voter assistance to individuals with disabilities over the past several years, along with performing a PAVA program evaluation, her input from the former PAVA clients, and she became, her perspective dramatically changed on this empowering work. Mary, could you tell us about how voting works in Vermont?
Sure, thank you. Thank you. Well, in Vermont, it sounds like we experienced some of the similar successes and also similar barriers that we just heard about from Paul and Kate. Vermont, as you know, is also a very small state. We have each town or city in Vermont has its own polling place, and some of the larger cities may have more than one polling place, and those are identified by ward. So altogether, there are 246 towns and cities in Vermont with approximately 263 different polling places. As we heard from Paul, I believe it was transportation to polling places is often a huge barrier faced particularly in rural communities here in Vermont. But on a brighter side in Vermont, there are only four requirements that must be met in order to be eligible to vote. The person must be a U.S. citizen. Secondly, a Vermont resident. The person must be 18 years or older by the day of election. And the potential voter must take what's called the voter's oath on or before the election day. And that's a swearing or attesting that the person will vote his or her conscience and not be told how to vote by another person. We do not have, fortunately, any competency standards for voters. And we are one of what I believe may only be two. I think Maine may be the only other state that has no restrictions placed on incarcerated voters or people with felonies, whether they are incarcerated, whether they've formerly been incarcerated, whether they're on probation or parole. They, as long as they meet those four requirements that I just mentioned, they are allowed to vote. We have no registration by party affiliation, so in Vermont we're not asked to declare a party when we register to vote or during the voting process. We're offered each of the primary party ballots, and then we choose which one to complete. We do not have same-day registration in Vermont, and that's something that certainly we've been interested in learning more about, hearing the pros and cons of that from others, and potentially advocating within our system to provide that. And so right now in Vermont, people must register at least 8 days before an election. As far as the voting process itself, registered voters have a few different options. One, they certainly can vote in person at the polls on election day, or they may vote early, either in person at their local town clerk's office or by mail via an absentee ballot anytime up to usually about 30 days before an election. An exception to this is for our incarcerated, our prisoners, who may only vote by absentee ballot. They're obviously not able to get to the polling place in person. And something that we heard Kate talk about is for individuals who are hospitalized at the time of the election, one of the difficulties we've run into, certainly everyone in the hospital can vote by absentee ballot, but however, we don't always, a person doesn't always know ahead of time that they will be in the hospital. And here in Vermont, we don't have a system in place whereby people actually may remain in their own communities or in a hospital in their own community. So, for instance, someone hospitalized may be 3 hours away from their town clerk's office who may be able to deliver the ballot if they were in town at the time. So that's certainly an issue and a barrier that we haven't heard specific complaints from individuals about, but certainly something for us to keep our eyes on and to work towards you know, doing something about that before we do hear from a particular person who's feeling like their right to vote is not being honored. One of the things I wanted to mention is the accommodations, and there was a question earlier about, you know, visual impairment and how that's accommodated. Here in Vermont, we offer the vote-by-phone system, and that is a system that assists people who may have difficulty marking a paper ballot. Anyone is welcome to use the vote-by-phone system. It doesn't have to be somebody with an identified disability. What the system does is reads the ballot to the voter, and then the voter indicates his or her choice by pressing the corresponding number on a telephone keypad. Voters can practice using that system from home before Election Day, and there's a particular number they call into. One of the downfalls, I'd say, in terms of that vote-by-phone system is that so few people use it. So what are in any given locality, there may be one person, maybe two people who use the vote-by-phone system. And what our Secretary of State's office has done to try to better accommodate the need for individuals to vote privately and non-identifiably is to have the town election officials also use the vote-by-phone system that day of election.
Okay.
We also have, similar to what Kate talked about, we do have the opportunity for individuals who are either physically disabled and not able to get to the polling place or who are ill to have a ballot hand-delivered to the voter's home by two justices of the peace. And then once completed, the justices of the peace will then deliver it to the polling place. And we also offer curbside voting in Vermont. At the polling place, individuals who are disabled or ill can have a ballot brought out to them in their car at the curb by the same method.
Okay. Lots of opportunities for folks to vote in Vermont. Lots of variety, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about your outreach efforts there in Vermont, and how often do you visit with people to make sure they have the information they need to vote?
Okay. Well, for many years, our PAMI advocates at Disability Rights Vermont have provided regular outreach to inpatient psychiatric facilities and the psychiatric units in designated hospitals around the state. Within the last several years, we've also begun the same type of outreach to each of the prisons around the state and also to residential and therapeutic care homes. When we, let's see, as far as how often we visit, there is only one state-operated psychiatric hospital in Vermont that currently has a census of between 45 to 50 individuals. And that facility is often visited more than once per week. The other designated units in the hospitals around the state, we usually provide outreach to those either once a week, some cases once every week, and there may be one or two that we may only visit one, on a monthly basis. And how we determine the frequency of visits is typically on the frequency and severity of patient and client complaints. As far as residential care homes, we do have, let's see, at least there's, I believe, 112 licensed residential care homes and 36 therapeutic community residences in Vermont. They typically are much smaller than the ones that I think Paul had talked about, with some licensed for as few as two or more people, and maybe some going into the 20s or so. Our outreach to residential care homes is really prioritized. We haven't ever been able to get to them all in 1 year, but in our priorities, we do commit to at least 20 visits, outreach visits, to our residential and therapeutic care homes per year. And we've also just started to reach out to developmental or shared living homes in the community as well. And those are homes where there may just be one individual with a disability living in a shared home and care-type environment. And how we prioritize which homes to visit is we've worked very well with, in some cases, other agencies who also have in their systems the means to visit those homes, such as the Office of the Healthcare Ombudsman. They have advocates, ombudsmen, who do some monitoring of our residential care homes throughout Vermont and also all of the nursing homes. And also the state's Division of Licensing and Protection. We talk with them. We gather information about their, the licensing reports, about concerns that may have arisen, systemic concerns, and about which ones they may see as most in need of oversight and monitoring. And from that, we filter down a kind of a priority list of the homes that that we can think that we can realistically get to.
I was wondering how everyone in these different situations, the relationship that you built with them, did you encounter any resistance or disagreement with you being there?
Well, I would say that yes and no. Certainly in some of the institutional settings, our work more often than the residential care home settings, sometimes just by the nature of the work we're doing, creates somewhat adversarial relationships. And that's particularly in those facilities in which we have assisted clients with filing several grievances, or certainly if litigation is underway in a particular facility against a particular facility. In our residential care homes, what we've done is we haven't encountered too much resistance. What we've started out doing was we've sent an introductory letter to every residential and therapeutic care home in the state to introduce ourselves, to introduce folks to our priorities, to our mandates. It also includes a piece about our access authority, which helps us to, using a PAMI or a PAD access authority, letting them know that we do have the right to come and provide information and to meet with interested individuals in their homes. But I think the most valuable part of that introductory letter has been our offer to provide training to staff and to residents about topics such as residents' rights, such as advanced directives, and, of course, the voter registration and education. In the facilities where we do encounter resistance working on building the relationships, I think one of the most helpful aspects for us is really common sense, maintaining our professionalism at all times, even in the face of the perception of staff that we might be out to get them, per se. Being interested in and actively listening to what staff have to say, it's very important. And even if we choose to respectfully disagree, giving the time to staff to figure them out and give them some time as well. And sometimes just striking up small talk and finding a common interest works wonders. Also, I think maintaining a regular presence at each of the facilities is extremely helpful. And offering not only to be a resource for the clients or the patients, but also for the staff themselves. And I think after many years of building these relationships in the facilities that we work within, we often find that facility staff now will seek us out to discuss both individual client concerns, systemic concerns. They will refer clients directly to us, and they'll look to us as a resource when they're not sure where else to turn.
That's great. And we have some information that you sent us for training to share with folks. So you all have that in your emails so that you can access them. How do you educate people about issues and candidates?
Well, one of the the ways that we do that, and we're very excited to offer this, our organization has created and published what's called a Voter's Guide for People with Disabilities. We have a primary advocate who has worked on this, put countless hours. And what this guide does, and I do believe it's maybe either linked or attached somehow so everybody can reference, is that correct? I hope. And if not, I can get the website where you can look this up. But it really provides everything from what your town clerk's number is to, you know, to ensure that you're registered to vote. It's a nonpartisan guide to the candidates. You know, providing one of the things that was talked about earlier is how do you provide information about candidates in a nonpartisan way? And what we've done is actually asked the candidates to submit, and we certainly have to ask each and every candidate if they're willing to submit a short paragraph about, and particularly what we've asked them about, is their work in the disability sector, or you know, issues having to do with disability rights and their take on those. So it also provides general information about the structure of our government, about what are these offices that we're being asked to vote for, about where and when to vote, and how to vote. So not only do we publish thousands of these guides, and we deliver them at every opportunity. So every time we're doing outreach, we'll have those guides with us, and we'll leave stacks of them. Every time we're out in the community providing presentations, it may be about something completely different, different aspect of our work, we'll disseminate our voting information, the voters' guides, or our voting rights information, or our brochure to call us about voting, and things of that sort. We also do targeted trainings and presentations to residential care homes, to community mental health centers, to correctional staff and incarcerated folks, as well as targeted registration drives also. And in those, we provide assistance with absentee ballot requests, registering to vote, letting people know where and when and how to vote.
Great. Is there any advice that you could give folks that are thinking of doing this type of outreach? How can they improve the work that they already do?
Okay. I think that I think one of the most important messages I've heard from clients, and in fact, I have been active in doing some program evaluation in coordination and collaboration with our local Center for Excellence, and really seeking out our former clients' input about their experiences voting, about barriers to voting. And one of the most important things I've heard from those folks is that they find it so overwhelmingly helpful for us to come to them. So for us to come to where they live, to where they congregate, to where they meet up, to their peer advocacy groups, to their homes, their residential care homes, that's a really, really important aspect of you know, improving the work that we're doing for voters with disabilities. I'd also say, you know, providing the information about how and where and when to vote, providing information about the candidates running for office, as I had mentioned, being available to answer any questions about the voting process. I think, you know, one of the things I've found in this line of work is that, you know, many of us often take voting and the voting process for granted, and sometimes not realizing that you know, somebody may not have voted because they simply, you know, it was overwhelming or they didn't know where to vote. So one of the things that we've done as a result of the program evaluation that I've performed, and I'm currently in the process of performing another one at this time, is ensuring adequate follow-up. So, for instance, when we register somebody to vote, even though the town clerk's office is supposed to send a confirmation to that person that he or she is a registered voter, either that's not always happening or people don't remember receiving that. So we actually, as part of our protocols, we confirm specifically with the town clerk's office, and we also inform the registrant that that person has been added to the voter checklist. Similarly, we provide specific individualized information to voters about where is your polling place, exactly where it's located, the address, how to contact your town clerk's office, how to request an absentee ballot. So really providing the information and being there hands-on in a direct way is one of the most helpful things, pieces of advice I would give.
Thank you so much, Mary. We can take two questions for Mary if there is anyone that would like to ask her a question.
Yes, this is Dolores Scott at the National Disability Rights Network. Mary, first of all, I thank you for that comment in terms of the PNA providing follow-up. The Government Accountability Office reported in December of 2009 that's a real issue, that fewer than half of the states provide training to their local officials, and also the failure to conduct oversight. I have a broader comment and question for the panel at the end, but Mary, specifically, when you talk about the ballots being hand-delivered by the Justice of Peace, what's the process to initiate that, and then how do you define a Justice of the Peace?
Oh, okay, Dolores. The process to initiate that is that simply a voter would need to call their town clerk's office in advance. And I'm looking to see if there's a particular how many days. I'm not sure. But it's as far as I know, it could be as little as a few days in advance or several days in advance. And the justices of the peace, those are actually elected officials themselves in each town and city.
You said election officials?
They are elected officials. They are people who have been elected into those positions.
So then that raised an issue as to whether or not it's bipartisan.
Well, I believe why they asked for two is that there's one, I believe there would be one Democratic and one Republican.
Excellent.
Or one
Thank
of the,
you.
One
yes.
of the
I just wanted to
parties.
Clarify that there is actually one from each party and perhaps an independent party as well.
Mm-hmm.
Great question. Any other questions for Mary before we move on? Okay.
This is Hannah from Oregon. I had a question about the vote by phone that you said was available in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
You said that people could practice at home. Can they also cast their ballot at home using this system, or do they have to go to the polling site?
Unfortunately, I believe it's only available at the polling site at this time. As far as I know, I'm not sure why that is, if they can practice, but it may have to do with trying to cut down on voter fraud and things of that sort that the state election officials might be concerned about.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. I would like to introduce our next speaker, Mickey Kawai, Elections Manager at Washington County, Oregon. Mickey is currently the elections manager in Washington County in the state of Oregon. Washington County is the second largest in Oregon and houses more than 500,000 residents. And it encompasses everything from farmland to Oregon's Silicon Forest, an area high tech firms. Mickey works with the elections for 21 years and supervises elections with 275,000 registered voters. She holds a BS in accounting and master's in public administration. She is an Oregon State Certified Elections Administrator and a Certified Elections Registration Administrator from the University of Auburn. Mickey has also participated in various overseas elections in Albania, Bosnia, Croatia, Serbia, Kosovo, and Kyrgyzstan. Nikki, welcome. Could you tell us about how voting works in Oregon?
Sure. Oregon is all vote by mail, so it's like a no excuse absentee voting. We have been all vote by mail since 1998. Ballots are mailed out to militaries 45 days, and I believe many of the other states are doing the same thing. 29 days before the election is for out-of-state voters. Those could include students, snowbirds. And the majority of the voters all go out 18 days before the election date. Oregon allows folks to register 21 days before an election. That does give us a little bit of time to send out our ballots, get them registered, because we mail them out 18 days before. The voters can update, and I say update, you have to be in. You have to register if you're a new voter 21 days before. But if you are already an Oregon voter, you can update and change your registration any time, even up to Election Day. And we readily give out replacement ballots even 5 days before an election. But you can always come to the clerk's office to get a new ballot. One of the things with the vote by mail is that it does reach a huge number of voters that are unable to go to a polling place. Therefore, we have a smaller group that we can really target our energy on that do need special attention.
What kind of facilities do you visit and work with in Washington County, and how did your program get started?
Sure. Most of the facilities that we have focused on are those independent living, assisted living, or memory care type. There are ones where folks are fairly limited in being able to leave the facility. As in terms of how did this program get started, it was basically because of how the Help America Vote Act, we started to focus a little bit on how to reach congregate care for folks. The very first time we started, it was all cold calls, looking through the yellow pages and calling up facilities to see if we could visit them and talk to the facility directors. But as time went on, we found out that we were better off contacting the activities director and become part of the recreation.
That's a creative way of starting those relationships. Did you encounter any difficulty when you were starting out?
Yes. I think on many of them, like I said, the very first time, we only really got to do three facilities. And it was really just to go there and deliver some voter educational piece and to see how many folks were actually registered. What we did was we ran a list of active and inactive voters that were residents of that facility, and they took that list with them as well as had an hour presentation to give to the residents of the facility. And having that list, I think, was the real legitimate key, because then the actual facility recognized that we were there to help them out with registering the folks that they had and to update any information that was different from the folks that were already there.
Did you develop any incentive programs for your program, and just tell us about that process?
Yeah, over the time, like I said, we started off with three. It has, the last election we had has grown into 42 facilities that we now visit. We are thinking about scaling some of that back because it has gotten to be a little bit too huge. But many of that has grown because of the word of mouth after we have been working with these facilities and the activities directors. We have developed a certificate program not, I shouldn't say it's a program. What we did was we got the Secretary of State to create this certificate. It's on a little pretty frame, and it's got her signature and her seal on it. And it pretty much states that we honor and appreciate the work that they have done to facilitate the program of the voter assistance.
That's very creative also. How can state governments and HAVA coordinators best support local and county organizations to reach voters in care facilities?
The first thing I can say is that money is the most critical right now. We have, like I said, increased our outreach to 42 facilities. And just off the top, the last election cost us specifically for this voter education and voter assistant piece with all the teams that we had cost approximately $22,000, $25,000. It's not a program that we can sustain for long, especially when so much of the state is cutting back on money.
Do you have any other comments that you would like to add to the conversation that we're having about working with folks in congregate care? Do you have any advice or any information you'd like to share?
I think most of the other speakers have really identified a lot. For us, it was just a matter of going out there because, like I said, Vote by Mail, I think, does reach a lot of people. So we were able to focus a little bit more. I hate using the term, but we went to, you know, the bang for your buck. We try to hit the larger assisted living centers, but I'm sure there is much more like the foster cares where they have maybe five or six residents in there. We haven't even touched those groups. Oregon does have what we call an accessible computer system that has, it's sort of a homemade, but it's very creative. It allows you to vote your ballot whether you have any disability. We've added, if you have mobility issues, we have this huge trackball that you can use or joystick pads that folks can use. Or it has a reading device for those that have visual impairment. We have those types of computer systems at the clerk's office, as well as portable units that we take out. And our teams do take out these portable units for those at the congregate care or the rehab centers. They are hugely popular with mostly those at the rehab centers.
Mickey, this is Ursa at the National TA Center.
Yes.
I know from talking to you in the past that your program started out with just visiting 3 facilities in your first visit, is that right?
Yes.
And then it grew to, now you guys are visiting an extreme number of locations. Can you tell us a little bit about how you grew your outreach and what are the best practices that you've really discovered there?
How we grew was like most of it was word of mouth. Once the team started going to the first 3 facilities, like I said, it was taking the list of the residents that were at facilities. And the activities directors and the facilities director recognized that it was a legitimate program. It was not a partisan program. We weren't there to encourage folks to vote for any particular candidate. We were there to just have the folks be able to act on their what we call the Bill of Rights for folks in care facilities. And going through this program, the educational piece, many of the other directors, activities directors, I guess they do have their own conferences, started to speak about us, and so they had started to let each other know that we were out there in this county. We've had calls from other counties that wanted us to come over and help them with this program, but these are other facilities, not other county clerks. These are other facilities that have asked us to come to their county and provide them with this type of program, but like I said, it just started to grow like 3, and then we went to 12, and then I think the next election jumped up to 20, and now we're up to 42.
That's amazing. I'd like to open up the floor for any folks that have questions for Mickey or any of our other presenters in our last few minutes here. Any other questions out there?
This is Dolores, again, with the National Disability Rights Network. So I'd like to ask the panel their thinking in terms of bringing the whole voting experience to the actual facility. You know, voting is such a community event. But, you know, for the most part, you know, folks who are in these facilities, their only two options seems to be the absentee or mail-in balloting. So what's your thinking in terms of perhaps mobile polling or bringing that entire experience to the facility itself?
Well, Dolores, this is Paul in Pennsylvania. There's a bill currently pending in our state legislature that would essentially do that, that would require every county to set up, I think what they call boards of elections that would go into every public or private institution that it defines to include personal care homes and nursing homes. But the biggest obstacle right now seems to be that the scale of the operation would be massive in the sense that I'm not sure that the legislator who wrote the bill quite understands that that would entail, you know, probably over 100,000 people, and you know, it suggests that it would be done on the Friday before Election Day. So it seems to be that one of the things that one of the things we confront is just the huge scale of the operation, Pennsylvania being, you know, a fairly large state, and you know, and embedded in that is kind of like, well, what day do you do it? Can you do it on Election Day? Do you have to do it before Election Day? Just, you know, because pretty much everybody in the election system is tied up on Election Day already. And if you do it before Election Day, you know, when, how far in advance of Election Day can you really, you know, schedule that? So I guess that right now what we're looking at how we could support this bill because it you know, speaks to our constituents, but at the same time we're kind of worried about just the logistics of it.
Right, and exactly, Paul. We don't need another unfunded mandate. But let me share this. The United States Senate Special Committee on Aging is looking into this, and we're looking, you know, ways that we can get funding to support that because the integrity of these absentee and mail-in ballots has become a major, major issue. And so we look for other options. Also, we get into the issue, is separate really equal? Mm-hmm. And that's what we see with these absentee mail-in ballots and also the fact that, for the most part, the report from the Government Accountability Office found that there were staff at the facility completing these forms and really leading the actual resident in terms of his or her choice. So that report came out in December. As a result of that and others, DEMOS is doing a National Voter Registration Act compliance project. And so we're looking at that as well. And since, you know, we're talking about voters with cognitive disabilities, in that report, the biggest concern that local officials reported as to their challenges was to how to implement their strategies, such as the difficulty providing voting assistance to residents with cognitive impairments. So having said that, when I say to the panel, do you provide a piece and your outreach materials in terms of how to service voters with cognitive disabilities, an awareness piece, perhaps? Or even, Hannah, perhaps you can address that issue, because that's something that we're also looking to include in a response to that report in terms of what our PNAs are doing along with our HAVA grantees, such as INTACT.
Yeah, that sounds something like something that our team could definitely help to address, since the majority of our team are voters with cognitive disabilities, and probably have some real ideas about how to address that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you know, Hannah, I looked at your materials, and they're very high quality, user-friendly to give to the officials in terms of a primer, a one-on-one, just making them aware. Kate talked about this in Rhode Island, that the standard for a voter, whether or not he or she is mentally competent, is not the same as to whether or not he or she committed the crime. It's basically, do you know what day it is, and is this an election day, and would you like to cast a ballot for X, Y, or Z?
Can I just add something in there? In Rhode Island, we don't actually have a standard. So what we do know is that you don't get disqualified if you were found not guilty by reason of insanity. And when people, you know, we at the Law Center haven't expressed an idea of what we think the standard should be, although I know there has been talk about the American Bar Association had a recommendation that if the person can articulate a desire to vote, then they should be able to vote. One of the things that I've been working to develop is training materials for staff who work with people who have cognitive disabilities, and I'm trying to get them thinking about ways that they can support people in voting in terms of planning and preparing and what goes into it, as well as the idea that assistance is not influence, and the person needs to be able to articulate a choice.
Great, and let me clarify, when we say at the national level, there should be no standard in terms of voting. Is what we're looking at in terms of persons who are confined by reason of their actions. So that's what we're saying nationally, and using that information to educate the state legislature and looking at their language and have the intense support that there is no standard, because right now it's a hybrid across the country. We run into problems when we have federal elections because they're also using HAVA money, and so we're arguing that there is no standard nationally. So I really appreciate Rhode Island's efforts in that.
This is Mary Postemsky with Vermont, and I wanted to add to the conversation in that back in 2008, the 2008 general election, the Vermont Secretary of State's office did initiate a pilot program with mobile voting in nursing homes. And there was a report released, it was in conjunction with the University of Pennsylvania and the American Bar Association, and the report that was released definitely spoke to some of those issues, but overwhelmingly, at least in print here, it was a very positive experience, not only for the residents of the nursing homes, but one of the things that was mentioned is the staff of the nursing home staff reported that mobile polling made the registration, it relieved their discomfort about assisting residents with cognitive impairment. And I think part of that is because our Secretary of State's office, and also we do a lot of collaborative work with Green Mountain Self-Advocates, which is a grassroots peer advocacy organization involving individuals with cognitive and developmental disabilities, and also our Vermont Center for Independent Living. There's a lot of collaborations in Vermont in which we actually provide and go out and provide education to town, elections officials, and to the people who are in need or requesting it.
Oh, Mary, this is Dolores. I really appreciate your sharing that, because Senator Reed, he heads up the Appropriations Committee, and they are looking to that pilot into Vermont as to, funding these public entities, and I also refer to them as PNAs, serving people with disabilities, and that was one project when we said that, you know what, this seems to work, but again, we don't need another unfunded mandate. So thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
Seeing the time, I do have to close our conversation about voting and cognitive access in congregate settings. I appreciate the time that all of you have spent to be on the call with us today and your questions, and I'd like to give a special thanks to all of our panel members. Thank you for making this such a success. And be on the lookout for the next teleconference. It should be as lively as this one. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you for having the call.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.